after September 11th, all America feel unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, and hated. You say, now that the whole nation's been niggerized, let's see what the response is gonna be.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, August 29th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A car bomb exploded at the Imam Ali Mosque during today's prayers in the holy city of Najaf, Iraq, killing 75 people, including one of Iraq's most important Shiite clerics. The blast destroyed nearby shops and dug a crater about 3.5 feet wide in the street in front of Iraq's holiest shrine. People screamed in grief and anger as they searched the rubble for victims. Nearby cars were torn into twisted hunks of metal by the explosion. A survey of Najaf's medical facilities counted 75 dead with 140 wounded, including many who were seriously hurt. Among the dead was Ayatollah Mohammed Bakir al-Hakim, who had just delivered a sermon calling for Iraqi unity. Shiites in Iraq are embroiled in a generational power struggle, but there was no evidence the bombing was the work of the younger Shiite faction, which has its strongest support in Baghdad's Sadr city slum. Both the al-Hakim supporters and a prominent figure in the U.S.-backed government blamed Saddam Hussein loyalists. Alistair Campbell, the combative, acid-tongued aide who shaped and guarded Prime Minister Tony Blair's image and became a key figure in the crisis over the government's Iraq policy, has announced his resignation. The Downing Street communications chief, who has been the center of a furious dispute over whether Blair's office manipulated intelligence about Iraqi weapons in the run-up to the war, said he was stepping down for personal reasons. The decision leaves Blair to face the biggest crisis of his career, the corrosive dispute about Iraq, and the death of a government scientist caught up in the storm without one of his most trusted advisors. It also is likely to be seen as an admission that somebody in government must accept blame for the row. The unelected Campbell was widely seen as the most powerful person in the government after Blair and was often described as the real deputy prime minister. A massive power failure in the British electricity grid caused blackouts throughout much of London last night, bringing underground trains to a halt and leaving 500,000 commuters stranded in the height of rush hour. Spokespeople for National Grid Transco, the private corporation that runs Britain's main power line, says that electricity was restored within an hour, and they blamed the incident on a freak event, a series of problems happening in quick succession. Spending lengthy periods in the absence of electricity is quite a familiar experience for people in Iraq who still await the restoration of full-time power, nearly 5 months since the start of the U.S. occupation of their country. The London power outage was also strangely reminiscent for many Americans and Canadians who experienced the largest blackout in U.S. history just 2 weeks ago. Stretching from New York to Michigan and spilling across the border to Ottawa, it left some 4 million people without power for more than 24 hours. Lloyd Dumas, professor of political economy at the University of Texas at Dallas and author of Lethal Arrogance, Human Fallibility and Dangerous Technologies, says that none of this should have come as much of a surprise since modern society is full of technical complexities and they're bound to fail from time to time. We spoke with Professor Dumas several weeks ago, and we re-air that interview now as investigators determine the causes of the London blackout.
It appears from all the reports that I've heard that it was not a terrorist incident. But what it does point up is the vulnerability of modern technological systems to disruption. In modern technological society, you don't have to create a disaster in four places by doing things in four places. You can create a problem in one place that transmits the problem to the other places.
I was wondering if perhaps there isn't obviously some vulnerability in our system, but if someone with ill intentions might have actually taken advantage of those weaknesses and performed some sort of terroristic act.
The possibilities exist. I can't say that there's any evidence that this is what happened yesterday. I suppose we'll find out as time goes by. But the possibility certainly exists. Let me point out something to you that I think you might find interesting. If you go back to September 11th, 2001, Do you remember there was a fourth plane that crashed into the woods, I think it was in Pennsylvania?
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the flight path that plane took, it came out of the northeast. It sort of looped around after it was hijacked, headed back toward the east coast, and it crashed when the passengers and crew fought with the hijackers. If you extend the path of that flight, look at the pattern of the flight, and just extend it about another 100, 120 miles, you're right over the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant. It's possible, although I can't say for sure, and I don't think anybody can say, it's possible that that was the target, that the target wasn't something else in Washington, but rather the intention was to crash that airliner into the containment building at the Three Mile Island plant, certainly the most famous, one of the two most famous nuclear power plants in the world. And in Lethal Arrogance, I wrote about the possibility that terrorists might eventually try to hijack a plane and crash it into a power plant. Now, that would have created a disaster of major proportions, perhaps an American Chernobyl.
Mm. You write, Lloyd Duma, that no technological system ever designed is immune to catastrophic failure as a result of human technical error. Can you talk about this in the context of some of the more dangerous technologies we live with, such as the nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction?
Well, if you look at the period from the early 1960s until recent times, let's say even 5 or 10 years ago, there were in the public records more than 89 nuclear weapons accidents. I'm talking about nuclear weapons now, not nuclear power plants. There have been lots of incidents and some more serious accidents with nuclear weapons along the way. There have been failures of the warning systems for America's nuclear systems, nuclear weapons systems. And those warning systems have failed in ways on several occasions that might have led to an accidental war being triggered. We also have had a terrible accident in Bhopal, India, at a Union Carbide chemical plant that killed at least 2,000 people in the city of Bhopal and injured perhaps 100,000 to 200,000 more. We've had Chernobyl, of course. The problem is that all technologies fail from time to time, and most of that we can live with. It causes a problem like this disruption we experienced in the last day or so, but it doesn't cause a major disaster. But there are technologies we're dealing with, like nuclear power, like nuclear weapons, like biological and chemical weapons and industrial toxic chemicals, that have the potential of creating really major disasters. When human error is just too common, and malevolence, including terrorism, is too common for us to continue to have these systems around. We ought to get rid of them and replace them with something that's safer, that gives us more margin.
Mm. We're also joined by Ross Gelbspan, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Heat Is On. Ross, I wanted to bring you into this conversation. You've written a lot about the need to turn to renewable sources of energy. Of course, if every building was somewhat self-sufficient and had a solar panel or wind turbine on its roof, the effects of this power outage wouldn't be nearly as dramatic as we're now witnessing. But looking at the Bush administration's energy plans and the recent war in Iraq, which many analysts say was essentially a war for oil, it doesn't look as if anything is on the drawing board other than continued dependence on fossil fuels.
That's completely right, Verna, and it is a very, very short-sighted policy for a number of reasons. And the first, as Professor Duma pointed out, is the vulnerability of grids. And if we had a renewable energy economy with people having home-based fuel cells and solar panels and regional wind farms and so forth, that would make the grid a far less strategic target for terrorists, and it would also eliminate the possibility of mass crashing, as we're seeing. I think there's some other connections with terrorism here also. If we were to have a renewable energy economy, that would dramatically reduce our dependence on oil, and that would diminish our exposure to the political volatility in the Middle East. And if you look at this issue from a climate point of view, the science is unambiguous on one point. Humanity needs, in a very short time, to stop its use of fossil fuels, to cut it by 70% globally. And what that implies is not only a switch in the U.S. to a renewable energy economy, but a switch in India and China and Mexico and Nigeria and all the developing countries that are struggling to stay ahead of poverty. And were the U.S. to spearhead that kind of a transition, since energy-related jobs create far more wealth than jobs in any other sector, that would do more than anything else in the long term, I think, to undermine anti-U.S. sentiment that gives rise to this threat of terrorism, which, as Professor Dumas said, was the first thing we all thought about after yesterday's power crash. So I think that's very important. And if you look at what the Bush administration has done in contrast to that need, essentially the White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal.
Ross Gelbspan is a political prize-winning journalist and author of The Heat Is On. Lloyd Dumas is a professor of political economy at the University of Texas at Dallas and the author of Lethal Arrogance, Human Fallibility and Dangerous Technologies. Rallies commemorating the 40th anniversary of the March on Washington were held yesterday in cities around the U.S. Voices of dissent are quietly being squashed in the U.S. as a result of the enactment of the so-called Patriot Act. Cornel West, professor of theology and African American studies at Princeton University, offers this sage advice and encouragement to learn from the lessons of the civil rights movement and calls on us to make our voices heard today. In this speech in Santa Fe, New Mexico, West ties the struggle for civil rights to the struggle for peace and justice today.
When will we be paid for the work we've done? For the work we've done.
For me, one of the great moments of American culture actually occurred in August of 1955. Very few people want to talk about it. In 1955, of course, Emmett Till was murdered by fellow citizens, victim of U.S. terrorism. The body thrown in the Yazoo River under the Tallahatchie Bridge. But his body was brought back to Chicago. And the first major civil rights demonstration took place. 125,000 fellow citizens walked by to take a look at Emmett Till. His mother left the coffin open so they could see. It's a Pilgrim Baptist Church led by the Reverend Julius Caesar Austin. And he introduced Moms Till Mabley, and she walked to the lectern. She looked over at her baby, whose head was five times the size of his normal head. And she looked in the eyes of America as well as the folk on at Southside Chicago, and she said, "What? I don't have a minute to hate. I'm going to pursue justice for the rest of my life." That's a level of spiritual maturity and moral maturity that does not give up on the Socratic attempt to interrogate the mendacity and hypocrisy of American life, but is rooted in something deep. It's rooted in an attempt to keep track of the humanity of the very people who have dehumanized you. Use that as a standard of responding to terrorism in light of the last 2.5 years. My God, how fascinating. Here's Moms Mabley speaking on her behalf and speaking for the best of the tradition. Martin King's in the background. Fannie Lou Hamer's voice is there. A. Philip Randolph's voice is there. And many nameless and anonymous black leaders who knew they had to deal with a situation in which they were unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, and hated for who they were. That's what it meant to be a nigger. Unsafe, unprotected, subject to unjustified violence, and hated. Now, after September 11th, all Americans feel unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, and hated. You say, now that the whole nation's been niggerized, let's see what the response is going to be. Interesting. I come from a tradition that says in the face of terrorism, it's justice, not sweet revenge, not short-term retaliation. It's justice. Hunt them down if they've committed a crime, yes. Demonize, no.
And even within the black tradition, if there are black folk who demonize, they are criticized based on that tradition in light of their not aspiring to the standards of Emmett Till's mother. And if that's the case, that's certainly the case for George Bush and other leaders. Crucial, indispensable, bringing together the best of the legacy of Athens, the best of the legacy of Jerusalem, but in the New World context in which legacies of slavery, Jim Crow, police brutality, lynching, discrimination, redlining and bank loans, on and on and on. Always connecting one's vision about one's own freedom to plight and predicament of others. Sisters of all colors, gay brothers, lesbian sisters, physically challenged brothers, indigenous brothers and sisters, so that they all constitute overlapping and intertwining traditions of struggle. But knowing that the courage to think critically and the courage to love, and I think we need to talk publicly about the courage to love. That's what I love about the best of the black freedom movement. You see, it's very rare that you find progressives. These are my dear white brothers and sisters speaking publicly about love. So why is that? Well, it's a longer story we won't go into. Just don't. Abraham Joshua Heschel did. Dorothy Day did. Early Michael Harrington did. The later Michael Harrington, who I worked with very closely, he had shifted from a certain Catholicism to a certain socialism, but was consistent across the board, and he was my comrade in both instances. He just changed his mind on some things. But James Baldwin talked about love explicitly as the most difficult, dangerous, but also the most significant force in the world. Why? Because if you come from a people who have been so hated, love can become subversive and transformative, beginning by loving yourself. Marcus Garvey talked about love explicitly. Yes, Elijah Muhammad didn't talk about loving white brothers and sisters, but that wasn't his only point. There's other people in the world other than white brothers and sisters. Now, he was immature to have to base the love of black people on devaluing white people, but he talked about black people loving themselves. Mr. Louis Farrakhan the same way. Much progress and evolution necessary in terms of his building on Elijah in an early stage, yes, but he's talking about loving themselves. Why is that important? Because it's a form of agency. It gives people a sense of confidence. And part of the problem of America is what? People don't feel like they have any agency. They don't feel that they're confident in making a difference at all. And especially in the States, where, my God, what was it in the election, the last election? 80% of white America thought the election was fair, and 80% of black America thought it was unfair. And somebody's right and wrong about this thing. I'm not a relativist at all. There's a fact about the matter. 32% of black people for the war. Nearly 75% is white America for the war. There's a difference here. Agency makes a difference for people who are cutting against the grain in their perceptions. Love becomes a form of agency. And not only that, but it helps break down the barriers, the walls of demarcation. And so even when the black rage and the black fury, the righteous indignation of having to look white supremacy in the face in all of its dimensions and still persists, the language of love still allows white brothers and sisters to recognize that it's not all of them, or is not genetic. The white brothers and sisters can make choices. John Brown is part of the movement. Tom Hayden's part of the movement. because it's all about choices, decisions, commitments. No one is locked into a pigeonhole or some category. So the love becomes crucial. And not only that, but of course I believe that it's impossible to talk seriously about fundamentally transforming America or any other country, but especially America. It's impossible to do that without talking about forms of spirituality, and especially music. Spirituality is all about how do you deal with your constraints and limitations. And when you run up against that anangé, those constraints and limitations, you're going to need something to fall back on, like a community that is sustained by levels of spirituality which have to do with contesting, which have to do with sharing, which have to do with sustaining persons so that they don't become short-term freedom fighters. Miles Horton, that great freedom fighter, 20th century, the white brother who founded Highlander Center, where Rosa Parks and Stokely Carmichael and a host of other freedom fighters would come out of Tennessee, move down to the South. He wrote a wonderful autobiography called The Long Haul. We need freedom fighters like Amy Goodman who are in it for the long haul. And that's hard to do. I know it's a lot of brothers and sisters from New York and Boston who made it out to Santa Fe trying to get a little distance from urban context. I can understand that. But you bring that tradition with you, because even in Santa Fe, the same struggles go on. Context a little different, bluer sky, okay. More beautiful mountains, yes, okay, I grant you that. No doubt. But you are the same moral, spiritual, politically committed human being here that you were in New York, in D.C., Philadelphia, Chicago, wherever else you come, and meet those who have been here for a long time. Brown brothers and sisters, go back generation after generation after generation. Of course, our indigenous brothers and sisters, century after century after century. When we come now to our present moment, what do we see? A bleak moment. Let's be honest. One of the bleakest moments in the history of the civilization. America is now, it's not only an empire, but in scope, in depth, in power, it exceeds the British and the Roman empires. Nothing like it in the history of humankind. No countervailing force at all. The repressive and regimenting Soviet Empire went under 12 years ago. It was a countervailing force. It supported Mandela when he was a terrorists for 27 years. We like to remind Americans of that. But there's no countervailing force at all. And like most empires, it's arrogant, hubris, feels as if it can shape the world in its own image, dictate its terms in terms of what it wants to do. And as my dear brother Noam Chomsky reminds us, not only put forward a new doctrine of preemptive strike, because that's a doctrine that says that if it looks as if someone's about to attack you, you attack them before they're able to. That's not what the new doctrine is. This doctrine says if a nation has a set of elites who are contemplating possibly challenging the U.S. power, they are subject to attack. That's preventive war. That's a new norm in international relations. It's the law of the jungle. And it sends signs and signals. Troops of 100 nations, bases in 70 nations, a major carrier in every ocean. Internally, 1% of the population owning 48% of net wealth, financial wealth. 5% owned 70% of the wealth. And that's before the tax cut. And the result is what? As you can imagine, the most vulnerable. Beginning with who? The children. It's already 22% of all of America's children live in poverty, the richest nation in the history of the world. It's a disgrace. It's a disgrace. The children. It's 7% in Canada. It's 6% in Japan. It's 22% in America. 42% of red children. 39% of brown children. 37% of black children. They are 100% of the future. Poverty educates. It shapes the way they look at the world. Gives them a sense of who they are. The untrustworthiness of existence. And here, the greatest empire in the history of the world has this plutocratic, oligarchic, to some degree still pigmentocratic, hierarchy in its economy. And then the most vulnerable, the children. And who are connected to those children? Poor women. Workers of both genders. Handicapped. Disproportionately black, brown, and red, yes, but numerically mainly white brothers and sisters. Where's the discourse? Where's the outrage? Where's the indignation? Or is it that the sleepwalking taking place has become so normative that we feel as if we can't make a difference? What is going on? Thank God again for our artists. When they get beyond the family dysfunctionality and vanilla suburbs, they can have broader canvases. Many do. The Lord, there's some dynamics going on the global scale. You see. And we know what? No empire lasts forever. All empires come and go. They ebb and flow. Chickens do come home to roost. You're going to reap what you sow. Sooner or later, reality is going to come back on you. You can only live in a state of denial for so long. You can only hide and conceal your structures and institutions in place that don't at the present highlight the dilapidated school systems in chocolate cities. Unavailable health care for 44 million fellow citizens. Difficulty regaining access to child care, especially given the welfare reform signed by a spineless Democrat named Bill Clinton. Playing political football with the lives of poor people to win the next election, trying to triangulate with the Republican Party. Ought to be ashamed of himself. Now, he's a friend of mine. I've told him this, so I'm not speaking behind his back. But just plain speech, frank speech. That's all. Just trying to tell the truth. With love. In the spirit of self-criticism.
Cornel West, professor of theology at Princeton University. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment with more of Cornel West.
Be proud of my country, 'tis of thee. Will we ever sing out loud, sweet land of liberty?